Hello and welcome to Media News. Media News aims to be an authentic voice bringing you real, truthful stories from the Middle East, with a particular focus on the Kurdish question that is often ignored, self-censored, or suppressed by the mainstream media platforms. Today, we've got the absolute pleasure of being joined by Dr. Cengiz Güneş, who is an associate lecturer in politics and international relations at the Open University. And today was supposed to be the renewal of the HDP's Kobani trial in Turkey. And so we thought it was a very good opportunity to discuss the issues of Kurdish political representation in Turkey with Dr. Güneş. So he's very kindly joined us today. The trial itself has been postponed until the 28th of May because so-called COVID restrictions. But we're going to talk about the issues anyway. So Dr. Cengiz Güneş is an associate lecturer in politics and international relations at the Open University, as I said. He received his PhD from the University of Essex in 2010. His main research interests are in the areas of autonomy and the accommodation of minorities, peace and conflict studies, the Kurds in the Middle East, the international relations of the Middle East and Turkish politics. He is the author of The Kurdish National Movement in Turkey, From Protest to Resistance, published by Routledge in 2012, and The Kurds in the New Middle East, The Changing Geopolitics of a Regional Conflict, Palgrave Macmillan, 2018, co-editor of The Kurdish Question in Turkey, New Perspectives on Violence, Representation, Reconciliation, Routledge, 2014, The Political Representation of Kurds in Turkey, New Actors and Modes of Participation in a Changing Society, which we're going to be talking about today. And he is also, more recently, the co-editor of the recently published The Cambridge History of the Kurds, April 2021. Cengiz, you're well published. I remember in the welcome to the show, by the way, Cengiz. Sorry.
Thank you very much for hosting me, Mark. And it's a pleasure to join you.
It's such a pleasure to have you here and to be able to discuss these issues, which you're such an expert on. I was saying to you earlier that I remember in the early 1990s as a Kurdish rights activist, sitting in an office trying to scramble around to find any resources on the Kurds. And doing a little bit of research this morning and looking at all the books, one that you've written on the Kurdish issue, which is such an achievement. But the wider influx and it's like a sort of, I don't know, a renewal. What would we call it? So many books on the Kurdish issue. Do you have anything?
Firstly, thank you for the kind words and the detailed introduction. And I remember when I was starting off, there were very few Kurds, and there was a conference in Exeter in 2009, and it was so refreshing for us then to meet so many new PhD students or graduate, they were about to graduate. And so from then on, in the past decade, perhaps a bit longer, the number of people who have been working on the Kurds have really increased. And what has also happened is that there's been a diversification in the sense that more Kurdish academics have been gaining PhDs and publishing. And so the field of Kurdish studies have really developed in the past decade. And there's so many books that have been published, it's at times difficult to follow all of them. And really, really exciting time for Kurdish studies. I'm grateful to be part of this new group of people who are really literally developing the field and taking it to a next level.
It's wonderful to be able to pay homage to them. And for the amazing work that they're doing, because I suppose up until the early 90s, you know, Turkey was doing everything. They still do to try and, you know, revise history, but certainly.
That is basically the what like one of the challenges we've been facing is to not only just do the research, but also counter the narratives that states have sponsored for so many years, and to actually kind of excavate the Kurdish stories from those, and to really narrate the Kurdish point of view.
Exactly.
And so that's been one of the challenges. But I think the Kurdish academics are doing a fantastic job, and they're really making a big difference.
I totally agree. And we're here today, obviously, with the HDP's the Kobani trial set to restart very soon. Looking at the history of political representation of the Kurds in Turkey, and your re most recent book published on the 27th of November of last year. The political representation of Kurds in Turkey, new actors and modes of participation in changing society. So I'll just read a little introduction from the beginning. Throughout the 1960s and 1970s, Turkey relentlessly persecuted any form of Kurdish dissent. This led to the radicalization of an increasing number of Kurds, the rise of the Kurdish national movement, and the PKK's insurgency against Turkey. Political activism by the Kurds or around Kurdish-related political demands continues to be viewed with deep suspicions by Turkey's political establishment and severely restricted. Despite this, the pro-Kurdish democratic movement has emerged, providing Kurds with a channel to represent themselves and articulate their demands. So this book is a very timely contribution to the debate on Kurds' political representation in Turkey. Tracing the different forms it has taken since the 1950s, the book highlights how the transformations in Kurdish society have affected the types of actors involved in politics and the avenues, organization, and networks Kurds use to challenge the state. Based on survey data obtained over 350 individuals, this is the first book to provide an in-depth analysis of Kurdish attitudes from across different segments of Kurdish society, including the elite, the business and professional classes, women and youth activists. It is an intimate portrait of how Kurds today are dealing with the challenges and difficulties of political representation. So, Cengiz, I will just very, very briefly, I'll just set the scene and the context for any listener that really doesn't have, that is a beginner to Turkish and Kurdish politics. Obviously, since the establishment of the Turkish state in 1923, the Turkish state carried out basically a policy of forced assimilation against the Kurds, banning Kurdish identity, banning Kurdish names, Kurdish language, any thoughts of Kurds being able to organize themselves politically. It was a very, very repressive time. I mean, it always has been, but from 1923 through, there was a resistance and revolt. People all refer to that the Kurds resisted, and the Turkish state brutally repressed any resistance by the Kurds, both in the 1920s, obviously with the Sheikh Said rebellion. Then later on, the sort of genocidal methods used against the Kurds in Dersim. And then obviously, the Ararat uprising, brutal, brutal repression. But then we come to the 1950s, where Turkey ostensibly sort of, shows itself to be some sort of democratic, so-called democratic country that has elections. And Kurds were then given, I guess, a political space to organize. So take us from the 1950s then, Cengiz. What happened then?
Yes. Yeah, thank you. I think you've expressed it quite well, the earlier period. And from the 50s onwards, I think the story is a bit complex. So on the one hand, what we see is a long history of from 50s onwards of Kurdish individuals participating in Turkish political institutions. So they were elected as MPs to the parliament, and they were elected as mayors, and etc. On the other hand, there's always been, as you mentioned, a degree of suspicion around Kurdish political rights and demands. And so people, organizations, and political parties that advocated Kurdish rights have faced sort of repression. They were imprisoned, persecuted, tortured, and killed. So this was kind of happening at the same time. So we have two different kind of experiences. And in order to kind of make this complex story more comprehensible, I think what we need is we need to ask ourselves the question, what does it actually mean to represent a group or a community? And in my book, I use the theoretical discussion developed by Hannah Pitkin in her The Concept of Representation book. And I'm not going to go into detail, but I just want to mention the distinction she makes about two distinct notions of political representation. There's the descriptive representation and there's the substantive representation. Descriptive representation refers to the situation where representatives share a descriptive likeness with the represented. So this refers to similarities in terms of ethnic, religious, or cultural background. And in contrast, substantive representation is based on the notion of representation as substantive acting for. And here, the importance of representing or advocating the best interests of the representatives, best interests of the representatives is emphasized. So in terms of the descriptive representation, we could say that there has been a long list of Kurdish representatives who have been elected to political office at the national, at the local level since 1950s. The right-wing center-right political parties were quite keen to actually attract Kurdish elites, tribal and religious elites, and through them they wanted the Kurds to vote for their party. And this has been the kind of context which enabled Kurds or certain Kurds to participate in Turkish political life. And over time, they became kind of co-opted into the Turkey's political elite. And this kind of form of representation continues, especially with the AKP at the moment. And so you have Kurds or people who are Kurd of Kurdish ethnic identity, ethnic background, who are in these political parties. And but what they tend to do is they don't really raise the demands of the Kurds. So they kind of stay away from Kurdish rights or Kurdish group rights and demands. And on the other hand, when we look at the Kurdish substantive representation, there has been always a big kind of restriction. And this can go back to 1923 when the Republic was created. And since then, Kurdish rights have been this has been viewed as suspicious. And Turkey has a unitary and highly centralized political system. And the national identity is exclusively defined as Turkish. So this affects the way national rights are conceived of. So Kurds, for example, cannot demand national rights. So things like collective rights for self-government or national rights, educational rights, they cannot. Their demands for like a Kurdish language education are always rejected. And so the institutional setup is highly restrictive of Kurdish substantive representation. And people who have been advocating for Kurdish substantive representation have continuously been repressed, and the HDP's the repression that HDP is experiencing at the moment should be seen within that context. And
So, Cengiz,
so
so you're basically saying that over the, since 1950s, there have been, like individual Kurdish people who the state have tried to bring into the system and use for their own purposes to get the votes of Kurds, but have never been able to raise Kurdish demands. I remember it in like when I went to Turkey in 1993, for example, when I came back, people used to tell me, yeah, but the foreign secretary is from Lice, you know, and he's Kurdish. And I just walked through a town that was completely razed to the ground, completely destroyed. So it didn't really make much difference whether he was Kurdish or not. He was definitely part of the Turkish establishment. So that's what you mean by so then there arose political parties that did put forward Kurdish demands. Could you give us a little bit of a history about that?
But before I get into that, I just want to briefly mention that in 1977 there were local elections in Turkey and across Kurdistan, and some Kurdish individuals managed to get elected as the mayors in Diyarbakir, in Kars, in Batman, for example. And sorry, not in Batman, but yeah, the Batman was going to be elected, but they I think they killed him. And
Metizana
was elected.
Yeah.
So basically, it goes back to that period, but from late 80s onwards, Kurdish political representation kind of takes a more organized form. And this started with the establishment of the first pro-Kurdish party, the People's Labour Party, in June 1990. And in the elections in 91, they managed to win 22 seats. But despite that sort of parliamentary representation, the movement kind of came under repression, and the HEP was closed down. And instead of HEP, another party was established to replace it. It was the Democracy Party, or DEP, which was also closed down in June 94.
That was the famous one that people will remember for the scenes of Leyla Zana standing up in the Turkish parliament for the first time in a very controversial speech, making a very brave and controversial speech from a Turkish point of view.
Yes. And she added a sentence to the Oath of Allegiance and that she had to read out. And that created an uproar in Turkey. And it was very, very repression. The level of repression was really high. Thousands of their activists were imprisoned, tortured. Hundreds were murdered. And the MPs were imprisoned, and so as well as the two political parties that were closed, sort of the repression had various other dimensions too. And the Constitutional Court also subsequently closed down two other Kurdish political parties, pro-Kurdish political parties, and these were the People's Democratic Party, the HADEP, and Democratic Society Party in 2009. But despite this sort of enormous repression, the pro-Kurdish political movement has managed to kind of grow and become a bigger and more established force. And they have been committed to achieving Kurdish rights within a democratic framework in Turkey, and they participated in elections, and in 2007 onwards, they've been represented again in the parliament. I wanted to also say something about the way I describe the political party. I use the word pro-Kurdish rather than Kurdish, and some people kind of object to that, which I understand. But the reason I use that is because in Turkey, you cannot have any political party that is representing a specific section of the society. So you cannot actually have a political party that represents the Kurds legally. And that restriction has really shaped the way these parties have talked about their political demands. They've talked about the kind of the vision of Turkey they have. And for them, having sort of Kurdish rights is a big part of their political demands, but they need to express it through a more general discourse that is kind of aimed at achieving democracy and pluralism in Turkey. And I think it's because of that I believe pro-Kurdish is a right
Political
discourse.
parties. Sorry, Genghis, to
Yep.
interrupt you there, but just for the our listeners, like the pro-Kurdish political parties have always had this historically have had this struggle with getting past this 10% threshold. Could you explain to us what this 10% threshold is?
Yes, thank you, Mark. So basically, as I mentioned, there are institutional restrictions, and one of them is the 10% threshold. Basically, that means for any political party to gain representation in the parliament, they need to win more than 10% of the vote nationally. And in the 90s and early 2000s, the pro-Kurdish parties were not able to do that. And in from mid nine, sorry, from mid 2000s, they managed to kind of overcome that barrier by putting forward independent candidates. And then in 2015 onwards, they kind of gained confidence that they can actually pass that 10%. And that is when they again started to participate in the election as a political party, and HDP was the People's Democratic Party was the first one to do that.
Okay, well, let's move on to the HDP then. The HDP were then formed in 2012, is that right?
Yes,
Yeah.
and it's the basically there's the People's Democratic Congress, and which is a body that aims at bringing various pro-democracy, progressive forces in Turkey together. And HDP was established so that it will unite the left in Turkey and also sort of achieve representation for the Kurds. And it was viewed with some degree of suspicion amongst the Kurds. In a way, people didn't understand why there was a need for another party while there was the Peace and Democracy Party, BDP. And so even when Kurds were putting candidates as individual sort of independent candidates, there was always an attempt to bring together diverse progressive forces in Turkey. And so, you know, that experience led to a greater cooperation between progressive forces in Turkey, which culminated in the establishment of the HDP. And HDP's rise in Turkish politics is actually quite a significant development. And sort of on broader level, we can say that the transformation in the conflict, in the Kurdish conflict during the 2000s, and Turkey's EU accession process have kind of contributed or created the conditions for the rise of the HDP. And so in the 2000s, the level of violence in the conflict decreased significantly, and this transformation created space for pro-Kurdish parties to promote reconciliation and democratic solution to the Kurdish question. And in 2007 onwards, from 2007 onwards, they were represented at the parliament, and they were running many local authorities, which enabled them to establish a strong regional and national presence. And legal reforms the government carried out to meet the EU accession process kind of helped them, because it sort of created a more democratic environment, and the language reforms around language rights and broadcasting kind of contributed to the view that Kurdish rights in Turkey were legitimate rights. So that transformation, in a way, created the conditions for the rise of HDP. And so also in 2013 and 2015, there was a peace kind of dialogue or peace process, some people call it. And that really created opportunities for the HDP because they were the key actors in that process, and they were addressing the media, they were appearing on TV stations, and so that kind of gave them the opportunity to directly appeal to the Turkish kind of public. So Turks and Turkish voters started to see a different kind of view of the HDP and the Kurds, and the view that HDP was a legitimate political actor that was working towards the good of the whole of Turkey began to be accepted by a wider audience in Turkey. And also, we should not forget Mr. Selahattin Demirtas's contribution. He was a very strong media performer, and he was really managed to win much praise from a wider section of Turkish society. And finally, we could identify the election strategy that the HDP followed as something that contributed to the success. In Western Turkey, they included sort of people that would have appealed to Alevi community, the socialists or the feminists. And in the Kurdish majority regions, they incorporated candidates that would appeal to the religious and the tribal Kurds. So consequently, by including diverse candidates, the HDP successfully managed to mobilize a large section of Turkey's population and managed to win votes from the religious and tribal Kurds, ethnic Turks and Alevis and other minority groups in Turkey. And so in 2015, it was a big success. They managed to win more than 13% of the vote and 80 seats in the parliament. And that meant the AKP, the governing party, was no longer able to secure the single party majority. And that's when the repressions on the HDP started.
Yeah, you say, I mean, it's sometimes, you know, to quote figures doesn't really reflect the atmosphere at the time, does it? Because 2015 was such an incredible year. I mean, it was, as you say, you know, the elections in June. I just remember standing in the Kurdish Community Center and people were just overjoyed. You know, there was just tears in people's eyes, people jumping up and down. But then, of course, Erdogan called another election, didn't he? And which was then to take place in November the 1st of 2015. And in between the two elections, there was bombings, there was arson attacks on HDP. There was an attack on the HDP's election rallies. There was the Suruç bombing. There was the Ankara bombing where 128 people were killed. There was the Diyarbakir bomb where 4 people were killed. So, I mean, when we talk about statistics, it's important to remember, you know, what the state was doing behind the scenes as well, right?
Yes, exactly. It was, the level of violence was incredible, and the speed with which it kind of developed was also very, very, very surprising in a way. At one stage, I was actually in Istanbul at that time, and so soon after the election, there was a really nice atmosphere. People were really happy, and then gradually everything turned upside down, and ISIS terrorist attacks that you have mentioned, The repression.
Which HDP, by the way, put the blame on the government, presumably.
For, yeah, there was information that the government had, which it didn't act on. And so there's a lot of questions to be answered on the part of the government. And I remember in September, there was a huge kind of Turkish nationalist mobilization against HDP. They were burning the headquarters. They attacked pretty much every building, head up ahead. And it was really, really scary for a experience that.
Absolutely. And then, of course, there was the Cizre massacres and the Nusaybin and the Şirnak massacres after that as well.
So there was a kind of a huge repressive
wave.
And HDP got the kind of most of the
brunt of it.
So that in that context, there was another election, and still they managed to pass the 10%. But they, in a way, the context has changed so much in that period, and gradually the repression intensified. And in July 2016, there was the coup attempt, and the government declared emergency rule, and that gave Erdogan a lot of power to change the rules and bring in new rules as he desired. And as part
more
of
towards
that,
a presidential system,
exactly. Yeah. But it began before that. So in May, the Turkish parliament lifted the immunity of the HDP MPs, and it continued and it accelerated further after the coup. So on 1st September 2016, the government passed a delegated decree, and they removed the pro-Kurdish mayors and co-mayors from their position. They arrested almost all of them, and many of them have been convicted. For example, Gültan Kışanak, who was the co-mayor of Diyarbakır Municipal Council. And in 2019, local election, HDP managed to win the municipal councils again, despite the repression and despite the fact that so many of their MPs and other activists were in prison. They still did quite well. But again, from August onwards, HDP co-mayors were removed, and their position was, they were replaced by the district or municipal governor, which is the government appointed. And
this is quite an important point, isn't it? Because this has now since been rolled out to the rest of Turkey, and of course this was the first time that the so-called, what do they call, koyuns? These appointed government officials.
Kayyum.
The trustees. I mean, of course, now they're being wheeled out everywhere, all over Turkey, in the universities and NGOs and everywhere.
Yeah, but but it's becoming more common. But I think there needs to be a point that this, for the Kurds, I mean, they are the main, their main target is the ending Kurdish political representation. And they've done it quite well, in a way, if that's the right word. Yeah. They've succeeded, and they have removed all the municipal elected sort of officials. And almost all HDP-run councils are taken over by the government-appointed trustee. And so that was the kind of the next level of repression. And then, and throughout the 2000s, the repressions continued. Many of the elected officials, MPs were arrested. Former MPs were arrested in the so-called Kobani file, or Kobani case, which you mentioned at the beginning. This is the case that's ongoing. And even though previously this case or these people were investigated for the protests and the court couldn't find anything on them. So this is a completely politically motivated case. And we need to see it within the context of the repression of the HDP. And so I mean, in a way, the government has done all it can to prevent HDP from winning elections. But despite all that repression, HDP still managed to or manages to hold its support base. And it seems that for to stop the head of HDP, what they need is to close the party down. And in December, from December onwards, the MHP, the Nationalist Movement Party leader, has been calling for the closure of the HDP. And other nationalist politicians have made similar calls. And so in March, there was a case brought to the Constitutional Court to close the HDP. And basically, they prepared an indictment, and they claim that HDP has become the focus of actions against the indivisible unity of the state with its territory and nation. And they demand that 684 former and current members of the party should be banned from from doing politics for 5 years. And what happened was the Constitutional Court sent the file back because there was not enough evidence in their mind to link the H to conv to be convinced that HDP has actually become a focus of actions against the state's indivisible unity. So what they're trying to do with the case of the Kobani case is to create a sort of a stronger argument that the HDP has become the center of activities and actions against the indivisible unity of the state. And so sort of that is what's happening. I mean, HDP officials have already mentioned this several times, that it's a politically motivated case. And on the first day of the hearing, on 26th of April, there was widespread, wasn't there irregularities? The lawyers were not present, were prevented from entering the courtroom, and so on. So you could see how they are actually conducting the case. And my fear is that it's probably going to succeed. And obviously, HDP and Kurds and everyone in Turkey who supports democracy should do all they can to prevent that happening.
Yeah, I
But
mean, it's, I
that's
mean,
the stage we're at.
yeah, I mean, just to, in summary, then, I mean, HDP is obviously, the latest of a long line of Kurdish political representation in the Turkish parliament, and by far probably the most successful in terms of its strategy of including of making alliances and united fronts with women, LGBT, with the youth, as you pointed out earlier. And now we're at in a position where, because of Erdogan has just taken all his powers to himself and has a presidential under his presidential dictatorial rule, he is by any means necessary. He seems that he wants to crush not just the HDP, but the political movement in in South Kurdistan, in Rojava, and he's waited. I mean, it's so obvious to everybody that they wait 6 years before they take out this Kobani case, which revolves around a couple of tweets, which even the European Parliament had said was completely within the framework of freedom of expression. Cengiz, thank you so much for that. Well, can I just ask you one last question? And we've gone a bit over time, but and maybe it's not a fair question to ask you, you know, because of the success of the HDP, you know, what comes next? Do you think from your perspective, what do you think? Do you think there will be a sort of a reaction from Turkish Kurdish society to the closure of HDP? And do you think that it would be possible for the HDP to further the project in terms of being able to form new alliances with other opposition parties and to build this project even further? Or do you think, I mean, God forbid that the democratic road is completely closed for the Kurds in Turkey?
Yeah, it's a tough question to answer. Basically, the way they've designed the presidential system had kind of Kurds, excluding Kurds in mind. But despite that, Kurds have managed to become part of the calculations. So in Istanbul, for example, Kurdish and HDP voter support was essential for winning the municipality. And so in a way, Kurds and HDP, they are working with the opposition, and somehow they managed to find a way forward. And so the way government is going on about is has the aim of preventing that that kind of cooperation developing into an alliance, and by kind of terrorizing HDP, by showing that they are a sort of a violent group, they're trying to break up that alliance as well. And in terms of it, much will depend on whether they actually close down the HDP or not. If they do, it will really change the game. It will change the game, because then there will the sort of contest will be to win the voters, that people sort of the opposition will try to win the voters that voted for the HDP without having to kind of coordinate with the HDP. But in an ordinary political, if repression wasn't happening, I'm 100% sure that HDP would have been a much, much, much stronger political force. And it would have been probably around 15-20% easily. And that, I think, really kind of scared the Erdogan regime, and kind of having a permanent Kurdish representation. And they have done everything they can to repress it, and it seems that they will do all they can to repress it more.
Yeah, well, Dr. Cengiz Güneş, Associate Lecturer in Politics and International Relations at the Open University, it's been a great pleasure to discuss with you today Kurdish political representation of the Kurds in Turkey. And we can only hope, I guess, that between now and the 28th, that more people, more political parties around the world, of course, the problem has been, you know, that people haven't spoken out really to the degree that we would, that is deserved and is demanded, really. So we don't know what the end of the trial is going to bring us, but thank you so much for joining us today to discuss these issues, and good luck with your book. Your book, The Political Representation of Kurds in Turkey, New Actors and Modes of Participation in a Changing Society, is available where, Cengiz?
Most published bookstores, and the publisher is Bloomsbury Publishers, so okay. You can buy on Amazon and Everywhere else, I guess.
Well, Dr. Gunish, I'm sure I speak for many, many Kurdish people around the world and say thank you for your dedicated studies to the Kurdish issue. Thank you very much for joining
us.
Thank you
very much for having me.
Thank you. Bye-bye.